ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The Music Show on ABC Radio National Summer. I'm Andrew Ford. Later on today's show, Richard Dawson is along, singer-songwriter from the northeast of England, remarkable voice, remarkable composer. But we're listening to music here by Germaine Taillefer, performed by Seraphim Trio. Seraphim put out an album earlier this year called Radiante, music by women composers, and quite a wide range of women composers, but all for the forces of violin, cello and piano, with the cameo for the viola. Anna Goldsworthy is the pianist in the trio. She's a writer and an educator, and you probably heard her as one of last year's Boyer lectures. She's also my guest on today's music show. First movement of the piano trio by Germaine Taillefer, and it's the opening track, in fact, of this album, Radiante, and it's the work of Seraphim Trio, who are Helen Ayres violin, Tim Nankervis on cello, and Anna Goldsworthy on piano. And Anna joins me on the music show. Nice to have you back, Anna. When you get back with the other members of Seraphim, do you just pick up where you left off?
More or less. Yeah, you know, it's a very ancient conversation now. It's been going for about 30 years. So it's pretty easy to sort of fall back into that. It doesn't take a lot of time to get reacquainted.
No. When you did your Boyer lecture and you actually had the other members of Seraphim there with you, you talked about your mentor, Hato Baele, and you spoke about him very beautifully as well. He's since died. Do you think of him when you work together?
Oh, absolutely. He was a seminal influence. And I think he kind of provided us with a sort of almost an aesthetic vocabulary, because, you know, you come together and you each have your different strengths and you don't always agree on things. And it's actually healthy that you don't, because I think a bit of necessary friction is important in any artistic collaboration. But what Hatto did was provide us with a few parameters, I guess. He had a particular interest in rhetoric and the application of rhetoric in classical repertoire. And so, I mean, I suppose we feel his presence most acutely when we pull out the Beethoven trios. We worked on all of the Beethoven trios with him, and my hard copies of the scores are still covered with notes of things he'd said about anabasis or catabasis or the rule of three. So he's very present there. But even beyond that, there was a certain sort of rigor that he brought to our trio that I think was really, really critical.
So what happens to the trio when you add to it? I mean, because you do. You work with singers, you work with other instrumentalists, and the violist Stephen King is actually on this album for one of the works.
Oh, we love adding to the trio. We're like a very ancient married couple that requires a bit of external stimulation from time to time. And so whenever a fourth party comes into the mix, it's always kind of enlivening and allows us to, I guess, get out of some of our routines and patterns, and they may challenge some of the ways we're playing or thinking or hearing. And increasingly, I think collaborations become a really central part of what we do each year. And I'm really pleased that it is, because we've had some beautiful, beautiful associations with other musicians. And as you say, yeah, most recently with the wonderful Stephen King.
I'm going to put out of my head the surprising image that you just introduced, but we'll talk about this piece that he's playing on, because this is a composer whose name I think I only came across for the first time last year, Dora Piachevich. Tell us about her.
Well, she was, like all the women on this CD, remarkable. She was a member of the aristocracy. She was a countess, Croatian, and really sort of passionately devoted to the ideals of music and art making. She felt that music was the most powerful of all the arts, the kingdom of the spirit. And so this is a really satisfying work to play. It's kind of a work composed in a late Romantic idiom. It's interesting. I was just reflecting on the fact that she's only a few years older than Germaine Taillefer, and yet it's a completely different style of music writing. She sort of still belongs to the 19th century, I'd say more than the 20th, but it's a sort of gloriously opulent and rich work. It's always beautiful to have a viola in the mix too, because it just expands the sonority and suddenly makes you feel kind of more orchestral. And she certainly leans into that sonority in this quartet.
That's part of the first movement of the piano quartet in D minor, Opus 25, by Dora Piachevich, and it's played by Seraphim Trio together with the violist Stephen King. Maybe we should talk about putting this whole album together, because you've got, well, one very much of the 19th century, one sort of with a foot in the 19th and 20th century, Ty Fair, who's really a 20th century composer, and then Elizabeth Unans, who's very much of our time. How did you start? How did you decide what goes with what?
Most of this program arose from a concert we did at one of the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra's really remarkable festivals, which celebrate women's music making, called She Speaks. And this is a sort of festival weekend that's been curated by the brilliant composer Anne Corse. And I had the privilege of joining her as co-curator one year. And we just thought this music was so vital and exuberant and brilliant and compelling, and there's not a lot of recordings of it. So we were just keen to find the opportunity to put it all down on disc. You know, we didn't call it A Room of One's Own or anything like that. We deliberately kept the title a little bit obscure. It's up to the listener to make the connection that everybody is a woman. I don't know if that's going to define their listening experience any more than the fact that pretty much every other CD on their shelf comprises music that's exclusively by men.
Yeah, and these composers wrote a lot of music as well, didn't they? And in, say, in the case of Clara Schumann, whose music, I suppose, was one of the first women to be, you know, rediscovered in modern times.
Yeah, she was extraordinary, I think. I mean, you know, sadly, she went on to say, a woman must not wish to compose. There never was one able to do it. But I think this piano trio stands in sort of stark opposition to that statement. It's so immaculately crafted and sort of beautiful in a rather subdued and melancholy kind of way.
Yes, that's right. Speaking of unfortunate quotes, there's one that you mentioned in your booklet about Germaine Taillefer, from her colleague and fellow member of Les Six, Francis Poulenc. How ravishing Germaine was in 1917 with her schoolgirl's satchel full of all the conservatoire's first prizes. How kind and gentle she was. What a charming and precious contribution her music makes. So, charming and precious, Anna?
Well, charming and precious. I mean, this trio is, it's not exactly, I mean, it's got a certain charm. I don't know if you'd describe it as being precious. It's sort of, the second movement particularly has an outlandish quality to it, to my hearing. One thing that really strikes me about this piano trio is it's got the unusual quality of having been composed over about 60 years. You know, a lot of composers don't live enough to compose a trio over 60 years, but this one, the first and third movements date from just before the end of the First World War. And then she only sort of completed the work in the late 1970s. And so it kind of maps almost a sort of history of 20th century music making. And you can hear a diverse array of influences from Impressionism to kind of more modernistic sensibility. She was, you know, as you mentioned, a member of Les Six.
And she's also, you know, her star has risen while other members of Les Six's makeup have sort of fallen by the wayside. In fact, I actually had to look them up because I could only think of five of them. I'd forgotten all about, was his name, Duret?
Yes, he seems to be the one that falls off people's radar.
Never heard a piece by him.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating work. I mean, you can see sort of familial Les Six resemblances, just a sort of rapid juxtaposition of musical ideas and so on. She's absolutely got her own voice, and it's a voice that somehow manages to remain not consistent but at least recognisable even over a 60-year compositional span.
I hope this is going to continue, this project. I mean, and I hope there are more works in the pipeline. Are there?
Well, we've commissioned quite a few works by female composers, and we're quite keen to put some of these down on disc as well, including a beautiful song cycle by Anne Corse. So it is part of an ongoing project to record works of women composers and occasionally even a male composer.
Okay, good. let's listen to some of the Elizabeth Unan piece. Thank you. That's the piano trio of Elizabeth Yunan. Tell us about her. You know, you're sort of getting in on the ground floor, really, aren't you? She's relatively young.
Well, she is, but gosh, she's brilliant. It was Carl Vine who put me onto Lizzie Yunan some years ago because he'd been a student of his, I think, at the Sydney Conservatorium before she went to the United States to study. And this particular trio, she wrote it when she was a student at Curtis, but it hadn't had an Australian premiere. So we were very pleased to get our hands on it. And then slightly less pleased when we realised how difficult it was, but then pleased again when we managed to learn it and put it together, and what a spectacular piece it is.
Yeah, it's a very strong piece. It has a big, strong personality in it, and you can't really ask more from a piece of music, I think, than that.
Yeah.
A last word about Clara Schumann, because we're going to listen to the finale of her piano trio in G minor. And this is a piece which has been, you know, unlike the Elizabeth Yunan, it's been performed and recorded quite a lot by different people. Does it feel like a classic to you now?
I guess it feels like a classic in the very small category of classic chamber works by female composers, of which off the top of my head I can perhaps think of two, the Fanny Mendelssohn and the Clara Schumann, but it still hasn't, I think, achieved that kind of iconic status of Felix Mendelssohn trios or even the Schumann trios, which aren't as played as often as some of the others. But I don't feel yet that a sort of forbidding interpretative tradition has arisen around it. So I don't know if that sort of precludes it from true classic status. But I suppose there's a bit more familiarity.
Yeah, but you don't want those sorts of traditions anyway, do you? You need to be able to look at everything fresh.
Well, that's the lovely thing sometimes about approaching this repertoire for which there are, you know, there's very little precedent in terms of other people's ways of thinking and playing about it. You get to base your interpretation on that first encounter with the score, and you know, we love doing that. It's what we love about new commissions as well.
Anna Goldsworthy, lovely to talk to you. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me, Andy. Always a great pleasure.
Thank you. the finale of Clara Schumann's piano trio in G minor. Radiante by Seraphim Trio is on ABC Classic. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National Summer. I'm Andrew Ford. Richard Dawson is a singer-songwriter from the northeast of England, just outside Newcastle upon Tyne. He's a prolific songwriter. He's released scores of solo albums, collaborations with bands, and also in the duo Bulbuls with his partner Sally Pilkington. Rich's music traverses quite a few different musical styles across his albums, but central to all of his music is his unconventional voice and unconventional guitar playing. His latest album came out in February this year. It's called End of the Middle, and it was our chance to talk to him about his world. We'll start with a track from the album. It's quite timely, really. This is Boxing Day Sales.
The streets are heaving and it's starting to hail. Golf balls of ice upon the Boxing Day Sales. Spot each other in a mannequin's reflection, sheltering under the eaves of French Connection. Over a scone is Ellie still tap dancing. Has Jenny kept up with her synchronized swimming? And are things any better between you and Tom? I'm so tired of hearing these awful Christmas songs. Time to change the record. A howl, a blizzard hurls the cafe door ajar. Are you owe it to yourself?
That's Boxing Day Sales, and it comes from the album End of the Middle. It's the work of Richard Dawson, and I'm very, very pleased to say that he joins me on The Music Show. Richard Dawson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You've put out a lot of albums, and there's quite a variety of them. Some of them are quite sort of heavy in terms of their sound. You've worked with the Finnish band Circle, and you've worked with synthesizers. And this album feels more homespun to me, more, I don't know, should we say organic in terms of, just in terms of its sound, really. I wonder whether you could say something about the sound and why you chose to work this way on this album.
The kind of sound of, or the aim of what it's going to sound like is usually one of the things that comes first, even maybe just as the very first song, so just forming. So with this one, I wanted to strip everything right back and have a very limited palette, especially after the last record was quite rich arrangements and quite sort of dense and lush in places, which was something I hadn't tried before. With this one, I wanted it to be very naked, nowhere to hide. And there's a few reasons for that. And some of the reasons were that it would sound almost a little dazed, weak, like some kind of newborn foal staggering around a barn. And then other reasons were I just wanted the melodies and the lyrics to really stand on their own. A little bit of a personal challenge for me as well, just to get back to very, very pure songwriting in a way that I hadn't since I was younger. I never knew so much what I was doing before, and I started to think, I'm a middle-aged man now, and I've been doing it a while, so perhaps I better check that I actually do know how to make a song. And then discovered, of course, that I have no idea what I'm doing. But this nice challenge to kind of reveal all of my own shortcomings and just to really let the melody speak. And I feel like modern music is so exciting, but perhaps something's happening to melodies, and with the internet, things are getting more, maybe melody is a little bit of a frightened animal at the moment, like maybe they're going to start culling the melodies soon. I wanted to put them out in the open.
When you speak of them as though they have personalities, and perhaps almost as though they exist and you have to find them, these melodies, is that about right? Are they something that you maybe don't work on in the same way as you might work on other aspects of the songwriting? They come or they don't.
Yeah, I think a bit of both is true, but certainly my experience is that they will often sort of appear almost from thin air. One minute they're not there, and then the next they present themselves. And it does feel like they're like living things, yes. I know a lot of other musicians and artists describe this same kind of process, that they're almost not present, or it's not them that's making it. And I think actually both can be true at once, that they are alive, they're coming from elsewhere, you have no control, but you're also an intrinsic part of it. My sort of way of describing it was to say that I'm a vase with a hole at both ends.
That's a nice way of putting it, yeah. The fact that you wrote the songs in the shed on your allotment is possibly relevant here, is it? That in terms of the sort of the homespun nature of it, the fact that there's a kind of this organic feel to the music.
I think when I started off, the idea was that it would just be, there would be no drama on the album. It would just be very simple stories, not even stories, just a presentation of family life and very domestic, just scenes with no action, no narrative, nothing like that. It turned out different from that in the end, for one reason or another, just led its own way, and also probably things within me that just needed to express themselves. But I think a lot of it was I've been probably fairly recently domesticated in terms of the, you know, I was always in chaos most of the time, and then just the last few years I live with my partner here, and we have got a house together a few years ago. We have got an allotment, all of these things, but the songs aren't about me. It's just maybe using, I was so interested in the allotment, for instance. It's such a wild thing when you get an allotment. You become instantly enmeshed in the community in a way. One day you don't have an allotment and you're kind of on the outside. The next day you have an allotment and it's like you're a main character in the village movie, you know. So it was also nice to write on the allotment. That felt appropriate, but also just it was a very practical thing, very quiet, and the horses would come and peer in the window from time to time.
Out the gate and up the lane, the allotment is calling again. I'm that Nelly every day. It's my happy place. When I'm on my hands and knees, ears filled with crow speak and buzzing bumblebees, the nasturtiums sway and worry slips away. Down the carrots and leeks, tying on the sweet peas, pruning back the branches of the pear tree, mucking out the chickens, repairing a puncture in the
There's a lot of things that you said that I'd like to pick up on, but let's perhaps just stick with the songwriting and the importance to you of treating writing songs as a proper job, as a 9-to-5. Does that make it easier?
Yeah, I think it's really necessary, like for me, because I have no structure otherwise. You know, I'll work on the music for however long until I've got, maybe it's a half a year, just waiting for things to come through until you have a bunch of songs. And then when I have enough, when I have all of it, then I'll start and work on the lyrics altogether. So I work on the lyrics like as if they were, you know, more like a book or something like that. I work on them all in one big chunk. So take 4, 5, 6 months. I don't write songs individually. It's like drawing blood from a stone. So, you know, you have to impose this structure, this kind of scaffold on your day, otherwise you'll just drift. There's no other way, I think. So for me, it's like the only time in my life that I'll be up before 8:30 is when I'm working on the lyrics, because I'm a night owl normally. You know, do 9-to-5 and just do it no matter what, and eventually you'll make forward steps, even if they're very slow and cumbersome. You just got to keep hammering at it, because I'm not a particularly talented writer, or I'm not a fast thinker or anything like that. So the only way to get through it is to chip.
And you're talking about writing words, but at what point do the sounds come into it? Are they always there? I mean, you said that you set out to write this particular kind of sounding album. Did that influence what the songs were about, or did you apply melodic patterns and instrumentation after you were happy with the words?
No, I mean, the music will suggest directions that the characters' thoughts are taking, and by extension the shape that the stories go. But I generally have the music pretty fixed before I'll start on any lyric. And then what happens is it makes a nice, because I'm trying to squeeze in too many words to too small a place. And so it means that you get nice variations in the melody, little jamming too many syllables into the end of a line or having to change it around a little bit. You're putting too many clothes in the suitcase, really. And it's like that vibrating suitcase that's about to explode. It's a little bit like that, but it makes a nice you know, you don't have to spend time building in those variations like you might hear in some classical music or some jazz things. It just happens. It's a natural sort of function of the process.
And the characters are very vivid, and you become the characters. I mean, on Gondoli, you sing, "I still can't believe I'm a grandma," and we believe you that you're a grandma, but you're obviously not. So these characters, are they from observation, or are they perhaps actually a part of you?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and I think that you could sort of ask the same about anything, you know, like maybe a book. I think it's more of a surprise in a song, because most songs seem to be sung from the singer's perspective, but we don't expect that of a novel. We don't expect it of an actor. So it's quite an interesting thing to work on. I don't need to talk about myself, because myself is just in there, and the things I'm talking about are kind of intrinsic to what's kind of going on through the album. But the songs aren't about me. But there's a lot of things drawn from, like starting points drawn from my life. Like the first song is about a bolt of lightning hitting a family house. And that happened to our family when I was younger. And it kind of spread out through the house and filled every room with light. So it's a great starting point. And the same with, like, there's a ghost story on there, and a lot of the details happened to an older relative of mine. The same with the allotment, you know, it's like this song, Polytunnel. We got this allotment, and it suddenly gets you thinking about lots of things, community life and being a couple, tending to something. But they're all starting points, but they're not me. They're not my family. They all go their own way. And hopefully for the listener, there might be hear their own story, see their own family in some of these songs, or see themselves, some of these kind of quintessential experiences. I think there's a nice contradiction at play, you know, the specificity versus the just quintessentialness of certain life experiences.
It makes me also wonder about tradition, you know, because you're talking to me from near Newcastle, and there's a very strong tradition of songs from Northumbria, and, you know, more widely in England. And just talking about the characters, you know, with traditional songs, you know, a man can sing "I am a maid that's true in love," and a woman can sing from the point of view of a ship's captain. And I wonder how much tradition you think lies behind your songs.
Yeah, it's a good question. And you know, years ago I made this a cappella record of kind of new folk songs, and I started going to a lot of folk nights, but I didn't know anything about folk music really. I've become interested since and tried to broaden my horizons a bit, but I didn't come from that kind of background. I grew up listening to metal and then experimental music, electronica and dance and more extreme kind of musics. But I didn't know much about folk, and I can certainly see the links with my music and a lot more traditional folk, but it's not the path, like I couldn't trace it back. I don't come from my dad played guitar, and there was a musician a few generations back in my family, but other than that, you know, it's not it's not in my lineage, so I sort of feel like I'm just finding my own way with it, and I have arrived at something that coincidentally has a lot of crossover with more English folk music. But for me, it probably sits more in something like novels, or I think about filmmaking a lot when I'm writing songs, and not so much songwriting.
On today's music show, I'm talking to Richard Dawson. He's just put out his latest album, End of the Middle. Richard, just talking about that a cappella album, I'm wondering about the way you use your voice, because it's very striking and unusual. You use the whole of your voice. And, I mean, on a song, for instance, like Poor Old Horse, there's, you know, you become the horse. When you soar up into that falsetto, we feel the horse's pain. And I wonder whether that is part of the songwriting process for you, whether you, when you're writing a song, you always know how you're going to use your voice at certain points of the song.
Not quite that. I mean, I think often, you sort of have hit upon something about becoming the character a little bit. And I think it happens to a lesser or greater degree with certain songs. That one you mentioned is an interesting song, because it's not really clear who the narrator is, some kind of omnipresent something watching over this knacker's yard and watching these three guys fail in their attempt to kill a poor horse.
At Gateshead in a tanner's yard, three young men were jawing hard. A poor old horse they'd fixed to kill. Befell a task to dexterous Bill. Poor old horse, poor old horse. Hear what they did to the poor old horse.
In terms of the voice, it's like I'm not a trained singer, which I think is probably evident. And in music, I like a lot of faults and shakiness, cracks.
Cry, he glanced it just above the eye. Poor old horse, poor old horse. Hear what they did to the poor old horse.
This is all nice texture stuff, and I think in singing has gotten more and more homogenized for a few reasons. I'm talking about Western singing now in England, America, and I guess that's spread in lots of parts of the world. There's a few reasons it's become homogenized, and I think partly it's modern recording techniques and pitch correct. I don't think a lot of people realize how much pitch correct there is on so much music these days, but also things like the talent competitions on TV. There's a certain way that you have to sing for it to sound professional. For me, I think often the best singing is the stuff that has all of these things, which apparently we're told make it unprofessional. It's all of these aspects where the voice is struggling. But that's the good stuff. That's like life. You know, the real good stuff happens when we're stretched, when we're out of our comfort zone. That feels much more when our best qualities are revealed. So I hope in some way, it's not why I started. I just arrived at it by accident. But as you go on, you have to think about why you're doing things a certain way. And I hope there's some embodiment of this embracing failure, embracing struggle.
Even though you made that a cappella album, I mean, the sound of your songs is intrinsically tied up with the sound of your guitar. And it's a guitar which seems to embrace all sorts of things. But I know you're a fan of Derek Bailey, whose sound I hear very strongly there. But I wonder whether you could say something about the way in which the guitar functions in your songs, the role it plays.
Yeah, I think that I didn't really realize how it sounded. Like, I know we said earlier on that the way the album sounds comes at the start, but I think actually a better way to put that would be I decide on the materials at the start and what I won't use, how limited it's going to be. But in terms of the actual guitar sound, I've just sort of arrived at that by accident, really. A few years ago, I got this there was a fantastic guitar shop in Newcastle run by a beautiful man, Brian. It's sadly gone now. He retired, and he would have been a merchant in whichever era he'd been born. He was like a Dickensian character, very great guy. I just came in one day, he said, "Rich, I've got a guitar for you." And sure enough, he did. And that's the guitar I've sort of been playing live since then. And it has this very snarly microphonic quality to it. I never heard anything else quite like it. It's a Burns New Sonic. So I sort of stumbled onto it, and I'd never realized quite how harsh it sounds, but a lot of my music isn't harsh. So I think it's really helped that. It's sort of where certain things might have been too soft, it's just helped give a bit of spice or a bit of roughness where it might have been a bit bland.
The tunings are obviously important here as well.
Well, yeah, I think because I'm accompanying myself, and you know, there's really like the bass side of things, and then this higher melody side, and you kind of have the, I see it kind of like three parts on the guitar. You have this mid range too, which is kind of like the weather. The bass is kind of, you know, moving the story along, and then the melody is the detail of the story. And so it's important that it has this heft, because I'm playing on my own a lot of the time, or else without a bass. You know, I played quite a lot in a duo just with my drummer, Andrew Cheatham, fantastic drummer. So the guitar has to do a lot, and it has to occupy a lot of space. So it's down-tuned four steps to it. So it's an open C major and occasionally a C minor, depending on the song.
We should finish with a song, and we can't decide whether it's going to be Removals Van or More Than Real. Which should it be, do you think?
Oh, well, you should play both, shouldn't you? But I would say, I don't know. I mean, I'm really proud of Removals Van. I think I don't have pride too much about things, but this one is, I think it's not the most immediate song, but the structure of it is a very satisfying one. It was really hard to do, and as a piece of prose and with the melody, it's a good one, you know. And I say that like I'm not I don't like to blow my own trumpet, but in this case, I feel like I'm really happy with that song.
Well, that's the one we'll listen to. Richard Dawson, thank you very much for being my guest on The Music Show.
Thanks for having me.
Over the garden my piano floats, with a bum note, followed by lamps, bedclothes, pot plants, flat screen, TV, your vast CD collection, and carrier bags distended with crockery. And now we're just waiting for the phone call from our solicitor. I grew up on White Bridge Estate. House backed right onto the old tramway. The smell of freshly baked oldies curls like a slow worm through my memories. Brand new skateboard echoing along. And climbing trees, great sea. carriage floor, blasting a razor blue Savannah. We pull onto the drive, our headlights like dancing sprites reflect in the porch window. The previous occupant, a retired civil engineer and recent widower, has left us a prezi in the fridge, a giant bottle of bubbly. Bad. When this ad made my dad redundant, all he'd do was watch telly, sinking like a having a curry on cross legs, surrounded by boxes. We take a drunken selfie and WhatsApp it to your family. Then I give myself a headache blowing up the airbed for our first sleep. Jolted awake, the central heating groans. Where am I?
Richard Dawson was speaking to me from his home outside Newcastle upon Tyne, and End of the Middle is out now. The music show's made on Gadigal land and mixed by Tim Jenkins, the producers Eileen Parnell and C. Benedict. And coming up on the music show's summer programming, Dr. Laura Case gives us a potted history of the violin in Australia from 1788 to 1914 and beyond. It tells us a surprising amount about class, gender, and resistance in the colony.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.